For the week of July 1st, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 152, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines in the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm back. We're back. I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. How y'all doing, Sperling?
Well, I see you're perfecting your Southern accent.
Not really, as anyone in the South would know, but welcome back from Spain.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad that I was able to win the Euro Cup for the country.
Yes, you took 2 weeks off from the show and scored 2 goals, was it, out of the four?
A header and a footer. I don't know what the other one would be called.
If you were part of that Spanish team, you'd be part of the greatest football dynasty in history. They've won 3 straight major titles. No one else has ever done that before. They won 2 Euro Cups in a row. No one else has ever done that before. They reached the finals of the Euro Cup after winning it the year before. No one else has ever done that before. They're arguably the greatest soccer/football team in history.
You know, certainly in the United States, we don't get a chance to watch football or soccer, as it's known here, on that level on a regular basis. But being in Spain during that time period, I can tell you that it is quite an experience. And you can really understand why it is such a huge sport all over the world, except for here in the United States. And, you know, watching that semifinal game that was decided on penalty kicks was with a whole town full of Spaniards. It was amazing.
Yeah. Well, 83% of the audience tuned into soccer in Spain, 81% in Italy, 56% in Germany, 50% in the UK, tens of millions of people, hundreds of millions of people watched it in Europe. We don't have any sort of European-wide numbers, but it was huge. And now the movie companies are thrilled that Spain has won and it's all over, so people can start going back to the movies again.
Yeah, you can understand why Hollywood and movie distributors kind of stay away from those football tournaments, because they really do just chew up everybody's attention, and everybody is just, you know, the matches start at 9 o'clock at night, so people are, you know, winded the next day and the day after that, and everybody's anticipating the next match. So it really is, it takes everybody's attention away. And you know, you mentioned all these percentages, but these are, as you say, hundreds of millions of people, 90% or between 80 and 90% of the, you know, Spanish viewing,
the TV audience,
yeah, in Spain watched this game more than when they won the World Cup.
Yeah. And they can now enjoy 3 weeks of movie going, and then the London Olympics begin. And
that's
everybody
true.
All around the world starts watching television.
That's true. But I mean, you know, one of the things I read while I was in Spain was just how much money is being spent on all of these football leagues in Europe, and it is a fortune. And guess who's spending most of the money to air these and broadcast these matches?
Rupert Murdoch.
How did you know that? Or you probably read the same thing I did.
No, Sky. You know, he's the satellite companies. He owns a lot of them. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's just paying billions of dollars.
Football is the great way to build up a cable channel.
That's right.
Or satellite system, sports programming.
Yeah. I mean, you know, think about it this way: just under half of all British audiences were watching that Euro Cup final when it was on.
And they weren't even in it.
That's true.
That's all right. So they, you know, but now they can breathe a sigh of relief and get back to regular life, going to the movies and listening to Showbiz Sandbox. If they listen today, what will they hear about?
Well, you know, I guess we've already started the show in a way. They're going to hear so much because we've got so much to cover and to make up for lost time. There's some television news. Charlie Sheen is back with a bang, and the Today Show.
I get that.
Actually, that wasn't meant to be a pun, but I guess actually that's pretty good. I made a pun and I didn't even mean to. And the Today Show was the other big news. They're trying to solve their problems by killing one of their own, apparently. Streaming music service Spotify, you know, we talk about it, what, like once or twice here on the show?
Something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm being facetious, of course, or sarcastic, but we talk about it all the time, and they have shaken up both the tech and the recording industry so much that now everyone in the space is trying to copy them, while at the same time, ironically, this past week, they decided to copy one of the industry's original pioneers. I guess original pioneer is kind of redundant, but whatever. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we've got a ton of news stories. We'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. We'll end with some inside baseball, where we'll discuss why that guy Rupert Murdoch that Michael mentioned turns out to be a modern-day King Solomon. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And as always, we cover the box office around the world, not just in North America, so you get a new perspective. In North America, the big news was Ted, the Seth MacFarlane comedy starring Mark Wahlberg and a talking foul-mouthed teddy bear. That was the number one movie in North America, but the number one movie around the world is a movie that hasn't even opened yet in America, and that is Ice Age Continental Drift. It opened to $78 million around the world, and it opens in the U.S. on July 13th. It's the latest addition in a massive franchise. Every Ice Age film has grossed more than the one before, so we'll have to see how this one does. Number two around the world is, in fact, Ted, which grossed $60 million. That includes its North American money and some previews in Australia, which were very, very successful. Seth MacFarlane is now the king of the world. Like the guys from South Park, he has transferred from television to movies very successfully. Maybe a Broadway musical will be next. Family Guy, the musical.
I could see Ted the musical.
Sure. Number three around the world is The Amazing Spider-Man. Now you may be thinking, what? It's opened? Well, not here in North America. It opened last night at midnight in North America, and it's opened around the world last weekend, mainly in Asia, India, Japan, South Korea, countries like that. So it's not open in a ton of markets, but it grossed $50 million for a very strong debut overseas. Now, of course, Euro Cup is over, and it'll spread around the world. 4th of July weekend here in America. We'll have to see how it does over the next week.
Well, didn't it open last night? I mean, it's July.
It opened last night at midnight, so right, it had some midnight figures. I almost went. I wanted to see it before we did the show, but I just couldn't make it. At number four around the world is Brave, the Pixar animated film. That grossed $40 million. It's at $158 million worldwide and counting. It has a long way to go. At number five around the world, another movie that made a big splash in North America, Magic Mike. This is the Steven Soderbergh film about male strippers starring Channing Tatum. It grossed $39 million, and we have some breakdown of that figure. The audience for that movie was 89% women, 10% gay men, and four guys who had dragged their brother wives who told them, you made me watch Battleship, and now you're going to watch Magic Mike.
So now you said 10% who?
Gay men.
Gay men, okay.
Yes, trust me, I was there in Birmingham, Alabama. There were maybe four guys in the audience. I felt like I was at a bachelorette party.
Okay.
At number six around the world.
Before we move on, I just wanted to say that if you listen to Showbiz Sandbox, we're telling you where all the women are. So if you're a single guy and you're listening to Showbiz Sandbox, we're your best friends.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. No, my sister's college-age daughter said, yeah, if a guy was there, you'd think he was gay. I go, if you're a guy, you should be there because that's where all the women are, and they've just watched a bunch of men strip, and they're all happy and ready to have fun. So if you're a smart man, you will go to Magic Mike. And number six is Madagascar 3. That grossed $28 million worldwide. It's at $424 million and counting. The first two grossed between $500 and $600 million, so we'll see where this one ends up. And number seven is the latest Madea film by Tyler Perry, Witness Protection. It grossed $26 million on its opening weekend. That's right in line with most of the other Madea films. And since it costs $20 million to make, you're doing pretty good. When you can gross more than your budget on opening weekend, even if you're a movie that's not going to go overseas like the Tyler Perry films, you're going to be all right.
How does this guy make like nine of these movies a year? I don't get it.
Well, they're inexpensive. He's got his own studio, his own production studio in Atlanta. He has TV shows. He has films. He has regular non-union crews that he works with and, you know, teams of actors. And he also does stage plays. You know, he's got a little media empire. More power to him. And number eight is Snow White and the Huntsman. That grossed another $19 million. It's at $335 million and counting. You know, they didn't turn a franchise. They didn't deliver a franchise, but they didn't lose their shirt. And number nine, somewhat similarly, is Prometheus, the Ridley Scott film. After a pretty strong opening, it's fallen pretty fast. It grossed $11 million. It's made $285 million worldwide. That's probably double the claimed budget by the studio of $135 million. So again, they're not losing their shirt, but they probably are not going to be chomping at the bit to make the two sequels that Ridley Scott wants to make.
Make two sequels to a prequel.
Well, he talked about two sequels to a prequel that will become midquels before we get to Alien.
Okay, just checking.
And number 10, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. Obviously, the film title of the year. $11 million worldwide, $46 million in counting. A pretty serious flop. Benjamin Walker should stick to Broadway, at least for the moment. At number 11, Men in Black 3. The Will Smith movie, another $9 million. It's at $600 million worldwide. It is the biggest hit in the franchise to date.
Now, is it 12, the biggest hit when you account for inflation?
God, no. They're only 10, 15 years old. There's no reason to account for inflation.
Okay, I'm just checking.
Yeah, come on. Yeah, At number 12 is the Wes Anderson film Moonrise Kingdom, which keeps expanding. That grossed $5 million worldwide. The overseas figures are very rough, but that's a good estimate that I could get of a couple hundred thousand. It's at $21 million and counting. It's not the biggest Wes Anderson film, but it's still got quite a ways to go, and it's still chugging along in North America, where it was the number 8 film for the week after expanding its screen count. At number 12, I'm sorry, that was number 12. At number 13, Captain Kirk, Chris Pine, continues to, step up from Star Trek and have some solo hits. He failed with This Means War, which has just reached $100 million overseas. And he's failed again with People Like Us, a drama that grossed $4.3 million over the weekend. It was trying to counter program to Ted and Ice Age, but all the women went to see Magic Mike. They did not go see People Like Us. So another movie where Chris Pine has not delivered. Hopefully he will soon, or hopefully he'll have another Star Trek movie.
But what does seem to be delivering is a film that I saw at Sundance and probably should have seen again at Cannes, but I had already seen it. And I didn't think it was as wonderful as everybody else, but I really want to see it again. Beast of the Southern Wild. This is the Sundance winner.
Yeah, and this is a real art house hit, a real critics film. You know, it's not a movie that has any big name or any big director or a big push behind it. It's a pure audience word of mouth hit. Opening weekend, it grossed $18,000 per screen. It's on 9 screens, so it grossed $169,000. It's not big figures compared to the big movies. It has the highest per screen average of any film on the chart. And it's just, a Sundance winner. There's no sexiness about it. It's just very good reviews. And art house audiences seeking the movie out will have to see what word of mouth is like down the road. But a very good start for Beasts of the Southern Wild. Our friend Aaron, who's been on the show before, he loved it. He thought it was great.
Yeah, I'm going to have to see it again because I saw it at Sundance where the hype was just so huge after the first screening that when I went in, I kind of went, yeah, it was good. But and now I'd like to watch it again. I wonder how many people, if this becomes such a huge hit, will name their child Hush Puppy as the name of the child in the film.
Well, a huge hit for this movie is grossing $5 million. I don't know what they paid for it, but, $5 million or $8 million or anything to $10 million, that would be a huge, huge success story for this movie, for the type of film it is and the release it's getting. So we'll have to see how it does. Magic Mike, of course, is already in the black. Warner Brothers paid $7 million to pick that movie up for the North American rights. I'm not sure why it only cost $7 million. I saw the film. I thought it was actually pretty well made. It's pretty sort of realist. It's more Boogie Nights than, Coyote Ugly. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
It's not.
Well, that's actually
not
probably a good thing, don't you think?
Well, sure, absolutely. I'm saying it's an actually sort of serious film. There's some sexy dance stuff in it, but there's a nice sort of low key realism about the way it's shot and performed. It's not a great movie by any stretch of the imagination, but it was pretty good. It shouldn't have cost a lot. They shot in Tampa, Florida. Matthew McConaughey is the only really big name. Channing Tatum has become a big name. He's had a great year, obviously.
Oh my gosh. Think about it. 21 Jump Street.
And The Vow.
Oh, good point.
The romantic drama, The Vow. Yeah, no, he's had a breakout year for him. So he's done really well. And it cost $7 million. I think perhaps the people who made the movie said, all right, we'll sell it to you for $7 million, but you have to commit to $30 million or $40 million or a $50 million ad campaign, because they know that if they spend a certain amount of coin to promote the movie North America, that makes it more valuable overseas. It makes it more valuable on home DVD. It makes it more valuable down the road. So maybe that was the trade-off they said. We'll give it to you for a little bit less, but we know you're going to pump up the film with a serious ad campaign.
They're also only getting North American rights, and it may only be theatrical rights. I don't know whether it's home video rights. So
probably was home video, but I don't know that.
Yeah, there are reasons why a sales figure like $7 million crops up, and a part of it might be, hey, pay us $7 million. Oh, and we get a piece of the box office. So,
right. So now, while you were away and we missed a couple of weeks, the Adam Sandler had a flame out of a movie called That's My Boy, which has been a complete flop.
Adam who? I don't.
Adam Sandler. Yeah.
Yeah.
Adam. And the same for Andy Samberg, who announced he was leaving Saturday Night Live right before this movie opened. After he saw the opening night figures, he might have thought, hey, actually, Lorne Michaels, you want to have lunch?
exactly.
So we'll have to see how he's doing. I'm sure he'll be just fine. But that was one of the big news. The other one, I think, was the opening of Brave, the Pixar film. When this movie opened, I tweeted, it's the death of 3D. And of course, it made national headlines when I did that. People were talking about it nonstop. I think it would have, you know, gone viral, except, of course, Tom Cruise broke up with Katie Holmes. She, you know, filed for divorce, and that sort of pushed me off the front page. But if it hadn't pushed me on the front page, I think we'd all be talking about how Pixar's Brave might be the harbinger of the death of 3D.
But don't you think that people say this about every film that's released in 3D that doesn't make $1 trillion on its opening weekend?
No. It did great opening weekend. Its numbers were terrific. It made $60 to $70 million, which is what virtually every Pixar film makes on their opening weekend.
Okay.
It's a commercial success. The news here is that on that opening weekend, only 34% of their tickets were on 3D screens.
Well, okay. Fine. 34%.
Now, 2/3 of the screens were set aside for 3D.
Now, that's what I wanted to know.
Right. And that's normal. You see that all the time. When you go to a box office theater and you want to buy a ticket, almost all the screenings are for 3D. And they're always the biggest and nicest screens in the theater. So they set aside 2/3 of their screens for Pixar in 3D. 1/3 of their screens were in 2D, the smaller screens, the less desirable screens. And that produced 2/3 of the opening weekend gross. Now, if you're a distributor and you're setting aside your biggest houses and your biggest space for 3D movies and they're half empty, and the smaller screens, the 1/3 of them, are producing the vast majority of the budget, you're not going to keep doing that. They're not going to keep setting aside 2/3 of their screens for 3D when people are actively walking away from them. And I'll bet some of those ticket sales were people who had no choice. There either were no 3D, 2D screens, or the times didn't work out because there were so many more 3D screenings available. And so some people paid for 3D when they didn't want to. I've done it myself. And they felt annoyed and gypped off. So even that 34% is probably a little high.
Wait, that's gypped, a very gypped low off? Number. Don't you mean ripped off?
Gypped off, ripped off, absolutely.
I think you've just coined a term. Gypped off. No. You heard it here first on Showbiz Sandbox.
And my apologies to the Romani population. But anyway, I really think that is a significantly low figure. This is a family film. It's 3D. It's animation. Animation works great in 3D. It's the one that works best. And families are staying away in droves. They do not want to spend the money anymore. When was the last time you saw a movie and someone said, oh, you have to see it in 3D? You have to. Prometheus, Spider-Man, the Avengers. Everybody I know has said, oh no, you don't have, either they didn't see it in 3D or they saw it and said, don't bother.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, that's interesting.
People are not doing it. I am looking forward to seeing The Hobbit in 3D. I will probably see The Great Gatsby in 3D at Christmas time and Avatar 2. But basically, by and large, Dark Knight, Spider-Man, these movies, I am no interest in spending an extra $3-5 to see a movie in 3D.
I think maybe Tintin was the last movie that people said, hey, you've really got to see it in 3D because Steven Spielberg and Peter Jackson really did a good job with it, which they did.
No, they didn't. It looked terrible. It was a horrible looking movie.
No, the 3D, the dimensionality of it.
It meant nothing to me. I saw it in 3D. It meant nothing. I wouldn't have told anyone to see it in 3D.
Oh, okay.
And it was a flop. It was a massive commercial flop. It wasn't a massive flop. I shouldn't say that. They probably didn't lose their shirt, though Spielberg and Jackson probably got the moon. But it certainly was not a big hit.
No, it was not a huge hit at all. Right. You're right.
3D can be artistic, but people do not want to pay extra for it. They don't pay extra for sound or color or surround sound or anything like that, and they don't want to pay extra for 3D. You want to put it in 3D? Fine.
Well, today I was dropping my daughter off at summer camp, my two daughters, and the youngest one, I said, hey, you're going to the movies today. You're going to see Brave. And she was very excited, and she said, but, you know, I really, really, really don't want to go to the one where you have to wear glasses inside the movie theater.
Yep.
She's 5 years old. And so when I dropped her off, I asked one of the camp counselors, I said, hey, are you going to see the 3D or the 2D version? And she said, and he just kind of looked at me disappointed. He said, no, we're going to see the regular version. And he said it in a way that was like, you know, I'm sorry, but we can't take all these kids to see a 3D film. There's just too many. It would cost too much. And I was fine with it. I think he felt he was apologizing to me, which, you know, I didn't really care. But
If you're a parent, you should know that the kids hate the 3D glasses by and large.
Yes, that is true. The funny thing is kids hate it and adults are the ones that that don't mind.
Well,
it.
Adults are rejecting it too.
Yeah, now they are, Avengers. Yes.
Yeah, I really think that's a very low number. We'll have to see how Dark Knight and Spider-Man do. I'm certainly going to see Spider-Man in 2D. The critic I know who saw it said 3D is unnecessary. It doesn't add anything. You're not going to feel like you're missing anything. You know, we'll have to see how it does.
Now, Dark Knight isn't in 3D.
There you go. That's right. And then I refused to see it in 3D.
There you go.
That's right. He made the first two in 2D, and he said he was going to stick to that. Unlike Peter Jackson, who made the 3 Lord of the Rings films in 2D and said for the 2 prequels, he's going to do them in 3D and with a higher frame rate.
Yes, that's right. As we discussed on a previous episode, I think episode 150.
I wonder if Peter Jackson is a member of the Academy. I would assume he is, but you never know. You get surprised when you look at the list of people who get invited to join the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences, the people who vote on the Oscars. It happens every year, and now they make the list of invitees known to us. And we looked at the list this year. It's 30% women and 14% non-white. And basically, they invited 176 people, and the vast majority of them are white male, as always.
Yeah, well, the Los Angeles Times did a study earlier this year, and as you might recall that we featured it on episode 137 when we spoke with Nicole Sperling. And they found out, based on their research, that Oscar voters are nearly 94% Caucasian and 77% male, and that African-Americans made up 2% of the Academy, and Latinos are less than 2%. Mostly, Oscar voters are, you know, they're older. They're a median age of 62, and the people younger than 50 years of age number, I think, 14% of the membership.
So 86% of the members are over 50 years old.
Correct, yes.
Yes. So, you know, and this isn't changing. 70% of the invitees were male, and not everybody accepts. 14% were non-white. That's a good step up. If they only have about 2% of their membership, that means that's, you know, seven times as many people as they have in their membership right now. So that would be slowly edging it up. But you look at the list and you saw a few people of color, a few Latinos, but by and large, white people, white males.
Yeah, I mean, non-whites were up by 4%. Last year was 10%. This year is 14%. Females was 30% last year. It's 30% this year. You mentioned some Latinos. Diego Luna from Milk and Y Tu Mama Tambien was invited, as was Damian Bashir, I believe, who was just in. Now I completely forget the movie that he was.
Well, he was up for actor in a film about a gardener in Los Angeles or an illegal immigrant.
A Better Life. And he was in Shay. Jessica Chastain, who was nominated and didn't win in the acting category, and then of course they invite designers and cinematographers and directors. Joseph Cedar, who directed Footnote, he was invited. I know the Dardenne brothers also invited.
They're only some of the best filmmakers of the last 15 years. No reason why they shouldn't have been invited till now.
Yeah, Terrence Malick, Tree of Life, and Thin Red, of course.
He's just being invited.
Yeah, well, you know.
Why wasn't he invited in the 70s when he made several masterpieces?
They forgot. And, you know, Wong Kar-wai.
Wong Kar-wai. No?
Wong Kar-wai, yeah. My Blueberry Nights and In the Mood for Love, finally invited.
Is that what you mentioned, My Blueberry Nights?
Well, that's what they mentioned, so I'm just mentioning.
Why would they mention it, for God's sake?
I think they go with, like, the last film.
Days of Being Wild, you know, 2014, anything but My Blueberry Nights, my God. And, of course, I don't know why anybody would turn it down, but not all these people will join, even though they've been invited. But I certainly would. And they all want their own, you know, they all want to vote on the Oscars and they all want to have their own category and they all want to be on television. I know the hairstylists have been complaining for years that they should have their own category. I think the real category that's missing is casting. Casting for a film, I think, is a really big category that gets overlooked. I think it often gets confused with just best film, you know, like the SAG sort of uses best casting as a substitute for best film or best cast. But I think it's a skill, and you can see movies where it stands out. Like Magic Mike has some good casting and some other movies. It's not necessarily the best film of the year, but they've discovered the most people. They present the most people. I think that's a category that's missing. But they've sort of given a new little bump up to hairstyle. They haven't given them their own category, but they've renamed the makeup category to be known forevermore as Makeup and Hairstyling Award.
What's really interesting to me personally is that I now know some of these people being nominated. And I don't mean, yes, we all know who Jessica Chastain is. But, like, I'm reading this list of, and you mentioned casting directors, members at large. These are executives and casting directors. And I'm like, oh, look, there's a casting director I know. And, oh, here's the head of technical operations over at Warner Brothers. That's interesting. Like, I actually work with these people on a regular basis.
Well, you're supposed to be an inside power player, Sperling. I'm the member of the media. You're the one who's supposed to know everybody.
I suppose. I don't know where to go with that statement.
Well, do you? I wonder if Charlie Sheen is a member of the Academy.
Actually, before we move on to television news, is it correct that I heard that Andy Griffith passed away?
He just died. I just saw the email about it. Yes, Andy Griffith is one of the many people who started as a stand-up comic and then segued into films and television. A long history of that. A lot of people came from radio and early television. Stand-up comedy has always been a source for some of the biggest TV stars, from, you know, Jerry Seinfeld and Ray Romano, on and on and on, Roseanne, you name it. Andy Griffith was certainly one of the early ones. He went from stand-up, where he was a cornpone guy who'd say, I went to see this football game, you know, or I went to see this here play, Romeo and Juliet, and he'd spin out an elaborate tale about presenting the story from his perspective, and that was what he was famous for. He went on from that to make great movies like A Face in the Crowd and No Time for Sergeants. And then, of course, The Andy Griffith Show, one of the most successful sitcoms of all time, spun off multiple, you know, spinoffs and sequels like Mayberry RFD and The Gomer Pyle Show. And then, of course, he had his own show later on, Matlock, you know, a long, long running TV star, stand-up comedy, one of the great, you know, Hollywood careers, Andy Griffith. And he also sang. So he had gospel albums on, you know, on the charts. I remember them being on TV. Just a terrific figure.
Well, the Andy Griffith Show, I'm sure Ron Howard's phone is just, that's where he got his start as Opie, the child on the show. I'm sure his phone is ringing off the hook today.
Well, yeah, I'm sure he's put out a statement saying how much, you know, he mentored. They had a long lifetime relationship, and, you know, that's certainly a great memory. He was one of the child actors, rare ones, to make the transition to adult success, both on Happy Days and, of course, as a director. So, you know, it's a success story for the Andy Griffith Show in that way. They had this kid. They all, you know, treated him right, made him a nice guy, kept him even keeled, of course, along with his family. But, you know, that sort of early success can really mess you up. So I think it's a testament to the atmosphere on that set that, you know, Ron Howard turned out so well.
Well, and, you know, when I worked at William Morris, they give the younger generation all of the people who might not be working as much, you know, they say, why don't you take care of Andy Griffith? You can handle Andy Griffith. I worked with Andy Griffith a bit and Jerry Lewis, and they were both phenomenal.
Hey, ladies!
Well, actually, I should say Andy Griffith was a lot. He was so nice.
Okay.
but no, I don't know. I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I mean, he was just a lovely person to work with and to deal with every day.
Oh, I thought that was a comment on Jerry Lewis. But they both seem like people who have long lists of credits that they didn't slow down with age. They seem to be pretty much in demand. It may not have been, you know, massive big feature films, but Jerry Lewis seemed to appear on television and do lots of events and things. And, you know, they both seem to be pretty active guys well into their 70s.
Right. Well, no, Jerry Lewis had a main agent. But no, I mean, it's, you know, Andy Gray. They're not the sexy stars like Matthew McConaughey.
Right.
Right. Who, by the way, Matthew McConaughey invited to the Academy this year.
Oh, well, there you go. What about Charlie Sheen? Is he a sexy star?
I don't know, but he wasn't invited this year to the Academy. Maybe he's already a member thanks to Platoon.
Right. He's certainly a hit on syndicated, on cable.
That's true. I mean, so do we need to go into like Charlie Sheen and Two and a Half Men and he got fired and now he's back with this Anger Management, which is a takeoff on an Adam Sandler, Jack Nicholson movie. And
Adam Sandler's probably wishing he starred in this TV series right now.
That's true. Well, that's true. So it's a half an hour. It's on FX. It set some cable records for scripted comedy series when it debuted in both total viewers and some key demographics. 5.4 million viewers for the first episode, 5.7 million for the second episode that immediately followed the first, which kind of makes sense. But I mean, literally the half hour after the first half hour was another episode.
It was an hour block of Charlie Sheen in Anger Management.
Yes. And then Wilfred, which is a great show. Everybody should watch it. Wilfred and Louis from, you know, Louis C.K. stars in Louis. And why am I forgetting his name now? From
Elijah Wood. Thank Frodo.
You. Frodo. You know, Elijah Wood stars in Wilfred. It's a great show. They were on right after this hour of Charlie Sheen and Anger Management. And they got huge bumps. 2.5.
Sure. They had a big lead in. So they did better than they had in their first seasons.
Yeah, and then I guess Russell Brand now has a talk show, Brand X, at 11 p.m., and that reached 1.1 million viewers. So, you know, Charlie Sheen gave FX a huge boost.
Yes, so that's the opening week. Now, there is a clause in their contract. They signed up for 10 episodes, and if they reach a certain number of viewers and they don't fall off too much, they will have an automatic 90-episode renewal. They've already paid the writing staff to get to work to do those episodes. They believe they're going to give the green light any day now. But they will, like Tyler Perry has done with his TV shows, like House of Pain, they will make 100 episodes basically very quickly. Quickly,
right.
Cheaply, get them done, get them in there. They're not going to do 20 episodes or 15 episodes a year and spread it out over 8 years. They're going to make them within 2 years. Everybody gets a good paycheck. Everybody's happy. Now, what numbers does it have to reach? First of all, they're tossing out the first two episodes. It doesn't matter what the first episode made. It doesn't matter how many ratings the second episode gets. They're not going to start counting until the third episode because they knew there'd be a huge tune-in. So after the second episode, that's when the clock starts ticking. See how much it drops after its debut, and most likely it will drop 20 or 30%. See how much it does in the third episode from the second episode. Then we start measuring. Maybe it has 3 million viewers or 2 million or 1.8 million. Whatever it does, they see that episode, and then they chart the next few episodes. And if they reach certain levels and don't drop off every week, then they'll get the green light to make the another 90 episodes. So anybody who says the show's a hit, it's done. You know, this is the tune in for a show that got a ton of press. Got to wait to see how it does. The first four episodes sold out of ads, so they're already making money on it. It's a good success overseas. They're selling out in countries all over the world. So this is going to be a profitable show. I'm certain they will give a green light to the back 90. But first, we got to see how episode three does in 2 weeks.
Well, I don't know if you read the interview with Charlie Sheen in Rolling Stone magazine, but it was it was interesting because you can basically tell the guy is mentally not there. He's mentally ill.
You diagnosed him as mentally ill.
I think the reporter diagnosed him as mentally ill.
Is the reporter a trained psychiatrist?
No, but I mean, I think there's something there where even he says, look, I don't know what was going on with me back then, back during my 2 weeks of, you know, infamy.
Well, it's 2 weeks. It's more like 20 years of infamy. But the point is, he's working, producing a show, and the firing of him from Two and a Half Men, you knew they had to pay him off because here he is with another hit show, showing up, getting the show done. However difficult he is, they made it work. They're making it work. So, you know, that was always a case that was never going to go to the jury because they did not have a good case to stand on.
Yeah.
CBS could not argue that Charlie Sheen was a shock to them in the way he behaved. He'd been behaving erratically for years, but he's been delivering on a commercial level. I have no idea what the deal is with his personal life. I don't deal with him. I don't know him. You know, he's functioning. He's making the show. He's doing the press, whatever.
Good for him.
You know, it's easy to say here, oh, they shouldn't work with him. He needs help. I have no idea. You know.
Well, I'm not saying
in
no way am I saying that people shouldn't work with him and that he needs help.
You said he's mentally ill.
Well, but that's a sickness, and that's something that people can work on.
Well, when you're sick, you need to get better, not work on a show and do press.
Well, you know, I think, you know, when sometimes people get sick and they continue to work, so.
You know who's feeling sick right now, and she's not working, is Ann Curry.
Yes, Ann Curry. Now this is somebody that I've always really liked. She was the newsreader, as they call it, on the Today Show, which is for those outside the United States, for 16 years, it was the number one morning news show here in the United States, beating out Good Morning America on ABC and the CBS early morning with CBS. I don't know what it's called over on CBS, which explains why they're in third place.
It's called third place.
It's called third place. The Today Show is on NBC. It was the number one show for 16 straight years, breaking all kinds of records. This year, Good Morning America beat it for 1 week at the end of May. It turns out that I believe the Today Show is still the number one show, but for the month, but not, you know, they missed 1 week.
But ABC's chipped away. They've won other weeks since then. So this has not been a freakish one-time incident.
No.
As we thought perhaps it might be. The dam has broken. ABC has a foothold. For the first time, the morning television is actually competitive.
Right.
And ABC won several other weeks since then. NBC has remained number one in the key demo, which is 25 to 54-year-olds. I hate demos personally. You know, I think, hey, people are watching the morning show, you should be happy. But in that key demo, NBC has maintained its number one status throughout all of this. But hey, we got a catfight, I shouldn't say that. We have a fight on our hands. It's an actual competitive environment again. After 16 years, we've been waiting for this. And that's why Ann Curry got fired.
Right. Ann Curry, I guess, Meredith Vieira, who was the host after Katie Couric. Katie Couric was the co-host with Matt Lauer, who is still there. Matt Lauer is the male co-host, male host. And Katie Couric was there for 15 years with him. Meredith Vieira came in afterwards after Katie Couric went to be the anchor for CBS Evening News. She was there. Meredith Vieira was there for 5 years. Then she left last year. And Ann Curry, who had been the newsreader for umpteen years, I think like 12 or 14 years.
I have no idea.
Well,
not that long.
She took over what she considered her dream job. And I guess things just didn't work out. The ratings dropped. Although, in fairness, the ratings have dropped on Good Morning America, the ratings have dropped for CBS, and the ratings have dropped for the Today Show. People are just not watching these morning shows as much as they used to.
But they didn't maintain their number one status. It's very hard to take over that job and be under that scrutiny. So, you know, sometimes the transition is really hard. Jane Pauley was a beloved fixture on the Today Show, and then she was replaced by Deborah Norville, who people, you know, treated as if she was Lady Macbeth stabbing, you know, Jane Pauley in the back. She was pregnant and fired from the show after less than a year. Then Katie Couric stepped in, beloved reign. Meredith Vieira had a tough act to follow, but it worked very smoothly. She was there for 5 years, which is a short time span in this kind of world. But her husband was ill. She had other things on her plate. She wanted to focus on her family life, and she stepped away from the show. They would have loved to have kept her on for another 10 years. You know, they weren't done with her at all. And so Ann Curry stepped into a very difficult position. Two people for the last 20 years had been just absolutely beloved. And she's more of a hard news person, and she does very good hard news reporting. And she didn't quite make the transition to that. You know, 1 minute you're talking to the president of a country or a major politician, and then the next minute you're doing a cooking segment. And that's a very difficult balance to have, to switch back and forth like that. Matt Lauer does it brilliantly. That's why he's been the host for so many years. Katie Couric, Meredith Vieira, Jane Pollard, they all did it well. Ann Curry was not very good at that. It wasn't just they're blaming her. You know, she did not settle in and get comfortable at doing that sort of back and forth between hard and soft, funny and serious. And so now Savannah Mitchell has stepped in. She was the other newsreader, and she's going to, you know, have a shot at it. So we'll see how she does.
Yeah, but I think that the way they handle this, I think, you know, NBC has been in trouble for some time. We've talked about it here on the show. You know, it's no secret. I thought the way NBC handled this was quite poor, but that's the way.
There's no good way to fire someone. How do you nicely fire someone? What did they do? They didn't mock her or leave her hanging for months. It snuck out. She was gone. You know, Savannah Mitchell stepped in. I don't know how they could have done it more nicely. What would they have done?
Well, I don't think things like this slip out unless they want it to slip. I mean, I think things like this
slip out. Of course they do.
On purpose.
Her people might have slipped it out because they said they want people to rise up and say, no, we love Ann Curry.
Yeah, and that didn't work because...
I wouldn't blame it on NBC. Who knows who slipped it out? You know, when those transitions are happening, people hear.
No, I'm not I'm not blaming on NBC. I guess what I'm saying is, you know, look, Ann Curry has been there since, I think, 1997, 98. And she's, you know, done a great job for you.
And NBC has praised her to high heaven. They've given her own team. They genuinely say we want her to be part of NBC News. We don't want her to go away. She's a very important person. She's going to be contributing to their new primetime magazine, which is not getting great ratings, but there you are. Maybe she'll segue after Brian Williams into the news shot, if that's still around. But I think they've tried to treat her with respect. They've given her, all the attention and positive feedback and tried to make the best of a bad situation. What else are they supposed to have done that they didn't do? I don't understand.
We're in a time now where it seems like companies are just rolling over people. The company comes first.
They've kept her. She had a year. She didn't work out. This is their single most profitable show. This is their single most profitable segment of the television world. It's even bigger than Late Night.
I know.
Today Show grossed $600 million last year, and most of that comes from the 7 to 9 a.m. hour. It's on for 4 hours a day.
I know.
That's a lot of programming Monday through Friday, and it's on Saturday and Sunday as well. But it's on 7 to 11 a.m. Monday through Friday, and the vast majority of the money comes in those first 2 hours when Matt Lauer and his co-host, Ann Curry, or now Savannah Mitchell, are in charge. That's a huge profit center. For the first time in 16 years, Good Morning America started beating it regularly in the ratings. Something's got to change. It ain't Matt Lauer. He's not the problem. So she's gone. But they kept her on. She's not homeless. She's not unemployed. And they've given her, tried to give her the visibility of saying, committing to her and showing that she's important, giving her own news team so she can create pieces for them. I think they've had her around for a long time. They see her as valuable, just not as the host of the Today Show.
Yeah, I guess maybe, I mean, you know, I can't answer your question directly.
See your girlfriend.
No, not at all. You know, I guess maybe one way to handle it better may have been, hey, you know what? Ann Curry's going to step down. We're going to have a couple of weeks where we're, quote unquote, looking for the new host, even though we're going to give it to Savannah Mitchell anyway.
Why would that be nicer?
That's
lazy. She's there. Just put her in charge. The one interesting thing I thought was that another possibility was a regular substitute host, and that's Hoda Kotb. I don't know if I'm saying that.
Oh, my God. No way. Are you serious?
Yeah, she had been bandied about. Well, she's on for an hour every day with Kathy Lee Gifford.
Yeah, and they're so bad that they have their own Saturday Night Live skit where people portray them on Saturday Night Live, Kristen Wiig.
Well, Hoda often substitutes as the morning co-host, so she's done it before, along with Savannah Mitchell. She and Savannah have both been substitute hosts for Ann or anybody else who's out. So they've been there in the seat. And she's done that. And so she was bandied about as a possibility. Everybody said Savannah or her. They tend to promote from within. It's often the newsreader or somebody from another hour that gets pushed up to the top spot. So that's a positive in a way. And she was bandied about. And the funny thing was, if she had been picked, people were saying, well, gee, Kathy Lee Gifford will need a new co-host at 10 a.m. Maybe Regis would like to do it. So suddenly people were saying, could Regis be back on TV with Kathy Lee Gifford? Didn't work out, but there you go. But today's show, $600 million a year. Good Morning America, $300 million a year. It makes half the amount of money that the Today Show pulls in, and it's still wildly profitable for ABC. So $600 million franchise, you want to make that going. You don't want to leave the ship adrift for 3 weeks to, as if that's somehow nice. If you got the new person you want, you put them in place.
Yeah, I guess, you know, public really, you know, look, there's a reason I'm not running these networks.
I got to be ruthless. Yeah. So does Spotify. You can't rest on your laurels. You have to keep growing, keep targeting what you can do better, or you're going to stagnate and start to fall backwards.
So exactly. That's exactly why Spotify said, we have to change something here. We're going to copy Pandora. Pandora, also a streaming music service. Spotify, of course. What's
the difference between them? What does Pandora do that they don't?
Well, Pandora is kind of like this music. It started from the Music Genome Project. And so they say, okay, pick a song, any song. Okay, it's a Josh Groban song. Well, here's a whole bunch of other songs that are just like it. And here's why. Their beats are the same. Their melody's the same. It's in a 4-4, you know.
So if you like Josh Groban, you'll probably like Andrea Bocelli.
Right.
And so if you pick Josh, we'll play you that Andrea Bocelli song. And then you tell us if you like it. And if you do, we'll say, all right, now here's a little Luciano Pavarotti. Oh, that doesn't work out. How about Celine Dion? Okay, great. And they build up your musical taste and start to recommend music to you based on your likes and dislikes.
Exactly. So that's what Pandora does. It's not on-demand music. You can't say, I want to hear Miles Davis's Kind of Blue. You could say, I would like to hear music like Miles Davis's Kind of Blue. Whereas Spotify is the exact opposite. They say, okay, pick an artist, any song, and, you know, you can listen to them. You want to hear Katy Perry's I Kissed a Girl? There it is. And then you can create playlists and take the music with you if you're a premium member. Well, on last week, they decided to upgrade their iOS app, so the iPad and iPhones, and I think...
What's an iOS app? What does iOS mean?
It's the, well, you know, everything that Apple has starts with an I, and it's an operating system. So it's their mobile operating system.
So it's their app.
Yeah, their iPhone and iPad apps. They now have these.
Is there another kind of app for Apple? It's just one of their apps.
Well, software app. So like desktop app.
Okay.
So they now have Spotify Radio, which is customizable, but not on-demand music like their initial offering. And in most countries, this is going to be free. So you can have a Pandora-like experience now through Spotify.
And so they're adding on to what they do. They're not changing their regular stuff.
Correct.
They still do that as well.
Yeah, okay. I mean, basically what they said is, wow, all of these advertisers, they know us, they like us, but we have nothing for them other than this on-demand stuff. What if we created radio stations and, you know, programmable radio stations? Well, then we could offer them yet another product. And that's what Pandora does. We'll do it too. And we'll have the on-demand. So I would imagine that Pandora is going to eventually offer on-demand music as well. Because it seems like everybody's copying everybody else. And, you know, everybody wants to be like Spotify. We highlighted this article from Business Insider, which I agree with you, Michael. I saw what you wrote in the show notes here, that it's a horrible article because it doesn't give you any figures, but it says that Spotify is the second biggest source of revenue for the music label these days, not right behind, but a distant second to iTunes. But they don't really tell you how much money that is, and they're estimating that iTunes paid approximately $3.2 billion to record labels in 2011, and that's an estimate by Business Insider Intelligence.
All right, so that's the figure. iTunes alone pays $3 billion to the record labels for songs and albums that they sell digitally. The question is, Spotify, they claim in this article, is number two. Well, number two more than physical CD sales, or is that just physical CD sales from a certain chain? Are they adding up together all CD sales and saying that Spotify is bigger than that? Or are they just saying Coconut Records and Tapes is, you know, not sending as much money to the label? So we don't even know what their number two compared to. So it's not a great article.
Well, and they're saying biggest source of revenue. So I would imagine
but we don't know how they're defining that.
That's true.
Because they're saying this is a particular company. So we assume they're not putting all sales together, because iTunes isn't the only one that sells digital music. What about Amazon? All right, iTunes is bigger than Amazon. But Amazon sells physical CDs and digital tracks. So how much does Amazon send to the record labels every year? We have no idea. How much does Spotify send? We have no idea. So we've highlighted an article that isn't very good. But we do know probably that they're a significant source of revenue for the record labels. It's online business and it's growing. There's also licensing and radio and airplay and all that stuff. But the online world is starting to contribute in a serious way to the bottom line of record labels.
Yeah, I mean, Apple itself realizes that it can't just stay stagnant. And there are rumors. Of course, there's always rumors about Apple and iPhones and what Apple's going to do next. They're apparently going to be, according to Bloomberg, going to be revising iTunes to improve sharing. So they're going to revamp it, as you know, I guess it's about time they revamp it. And they're going to allow users to share music with one another. And they're in talks with all the record labels to allow, you know, if I share a song with you, Michael, you're allowed to hear it maybe once, maybe twice before you have to become a member or pay for it yourself. So they're going to.
Right. So if you hear a song you like, you can send it to me and I can listen to it.
Right, exactly.
So or right now you could go to YouTube. Copy the link for that song because it appears on YouTube and send me the link and I can listen to the song already.
Precisely.
So, all right. So big deal.
Right.
So no reason why they shouldn't offer, but it's not very meaningful. It means nothing. I think the Microsoft news is a little more interesting.
Yeah. I mean, look, Apple's trying to change and add to their business.
They're adding a tiny little service.
Right. Yeah. And to, you know, enhance their iCloud offering. Microsoft is trying to enhance its Xbox offering. Of course, a couple weeks ago at E3, they launched Xbox Music, which was you know, aimed squarely at Apple and Spotify. And now they're going to try and launch a Spotify-style streaming. That is really hard to say. Three S's in a row. Spotify-style streaming.
They're trying to copy Spotify.
Yeah, exactly. So they're going to do it all through their app. They're doing it all through the Xbox. And I don't think that's a bad idea.
What's different from what they announced a few weeks ago at E3?
I don't know. No idea. Because I don't think that they really even launched anything at E3. They just announced it at E3.
So now they're clarifying their plans.
I guess. Yeah, I don't know. What is it with Microsoft, though, that they always have to do everything last? They want to create an MP3 player. They created the Zune. They did it like 5 years too late. And now, well, I guess they're moving up to 2 years too late with trying to create something like Spotify.
Yeah, everybody wants to converge. Everybody wants to be the box in your house that you do everything through, whether it's music, movies, TVs, you name it. And obviously Microsoft says, well, we've got the Xbox in homes already. Let's offer music as well.
Well, you know what? You want to be the box of my house? I'm leaving my house. I'm going to the theater.
Well, obviously, you've segued into Broadway, and Broadway is having a great summer, I think. I'm not quite sure why, but usually the summertime is a little slow for Broadway, but it's been a really significant summer, I think. I don't have any strong figures, but, I mean, Wicked grossed $2 million last week. The Lion King grossed $1.9 million. The Book of Mormon set another record in its house, and it does that by raising the ticket price. The top ticket price is now $477. That's how they keep breaking records at the Eugene O'Neill Theater where the Book of Mormon is playing. They keep raising the ticket price because there's only so many seats and they've been more than sold out for, you know, since the show opened.
So Broadway is not only taking their stories and their content from movies, but now they're also taking their business models.
That's right. Though happily, Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark is not in 3D. It's an actual live people that grossed $1.6 million. Evita is slowing down a bit, but Newsies and Once and what's it called? Peter and the Starcatcher have all enjoyed a nice bounce from the Tonys.
Yeah, I mean,
Evita was red hot for a while, but it has slowed down. But Newsies and Once, which were two of the big winners in the musical section, have really broken into the $1 million club. They're in small theaters, and they've been increasing their ticket prices every week. They've been basically sold out. News has been sold out since the day it went into previews. Once has been building its audience up a little bit every week with great word of mouth. They are now both bona fide hits. Newsies grossed $1 million last week, and Once, the little show that could, also grossed $1 million last week. That's great news for them. And Peter and the Starcatcher, which is a tiny little play, it got a good attention on the Tony Awards, won a key acting category. It's done quite well, and it's almost turning into a hit as well. So that's nice to see. But the big news is it's summertime, and that means shows are closing.
That's right. So you have Godspell, which closed on June 24th. The Columnist with John Lithgow is closing July 8th. The Streetcar Named Desire is going to close on July 22nd. Anything Goes closes August 5th. I guess End of the Rainbow and Don't Dress for Dinner, they're going to close. Who knows? They're probably closing as we speak.
Jesus Christ Superstar and the Lions both just closed. The Lions starred Linda Lavin, who was Alice on television. Sister Act is going to close at the end of August. But that has like four productions around the world, a North American tour launching, and eight more tours that are scheduled. So that's going to have a healthy afterlife. And, as always, they're always naming new big new shows. You know, there's always a new show in the works. Motown the Musical is scheduled for 2013, which sounds like a great idea, except that Berry Gordy is writing the book.
That's a bad idea.
That's a very, very bad idea, Barry. Get somebody else to do it for you. Don't call it Berry Gordy, because then you can make the character nasty or funny or mean or rapacious, because God knows you probably, as you built that place, you were not a saint.
Yeah, so, and if you want to know what it's like when people like that do the book for and do the music, hey, just ask Bono and The Edge.
Well, they did not do the book for Spider-Man.
That's right. Yeah, that's why.
They just did the songs, which should have been their, you know, strength, but that didn't work out too well. Cher is working on a Broadway musical. I guess she wants to, you know, meet Dolly Parton on Broadway.
Well, she's doing it about her favorite subject, herself.
Herself.
That's right.
And Mamma Mia, the people behind Mamma Mia are doing a Spice Girls musical. We don't care, but in Europe, that's really big news because the Spice Girls were a huge act in the UK. And so they have a musical that's not really about them. But it uses their songs to tell a story.
So it's like a song cycle.
It's not a showbox musical.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, it is a jukebox musical. You're right. It's a jukebox musical. They have 11 number one hits from the UK, and they'll be peppered throughout the show, girl power and all that. And the story is not about the Spice Girls per se.
Well, what about a radio station musical or a pirate radio station musical?
Well, you know, that makes sense, I suppose. It's a logical thing to use music. You're talking about Pump Up the Volume, which was a 1990 black comedy starring Christian Slater and Samantha Mathis.
In fact, it was Samantha Mathis' first role at the age of 19.
Oh, wow. There you go. First role in a film or anything?
In a film. Her film debut.
And he was a pirate radio DJ. I think he was called Hard Harry. And he, you know, would be on the radio and make all these, you know, cool guy, anti-establishment rants, and then play some great music. So they're turning it into a Broadway show. I guess on a certain level it makes sense. The movie had a great soundtrack, including covers of Leonard Cohen and other people. Concrete Blonde were on it, Beastie Boys, Sonic Youth. But they're not using any of that music in the show. It's all original music. The guys who are working on it have never had a big hit. They've been working in family musicals or fringe stuff. But this looks like it's moved one step closer to reality. So we'll have to keep an eye on it.
You know, I was working with a contractor recently, like 3 weeks ago, and this contractor who was from Israel and, you know, was telling me how much they really love this movie from the 90s. And I was like, oh, what movie? And he said, Pump Up the Volume. And so it's so weird that in 3 weeks I go from talking, having this long conversation about Pump Up the Volume, which is some like inane movie from the 90s, not a huge hit, to it actually becoming a Broadway show or a potential Broadway show.
Well, I wouldn't say it was an inane hit. I mean, it was a smarter than your average bear teen movie.
I liked the film. I really liked it, actually.
I thought you just said it was inane.
Well, okay. Maybe inane was the wrong word. Not a huge financial success.
No, it made like $11 million. I don't know what the budget was. But, you know, it was another step forward for Christian Slater in turning him into a star. Seth Green had a small role in it. He's a terrific actor. So it had a very well cast. So, again, nods to the casting director on Pump Up the Volume, whoever that might be.
I guess what I'm trying to say is it just wasn't a big deal.
All right. Well, that moves us along to Big Deal, Big Whoop, doesn't it?
Yes. That's our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Now, our first story, New Orleans, it takes another blow. And I guess if you're from New Orleans, you got to say Nolans. The hurricane force winds sweeping through the newspaper industry have dealt another blow to the city. News reports show hundreds of employees are being fired from already struggling outlets like the Mobile Press, Register, the Huntsville Times, and, you know, actually the Birmingham News, Michael, the hometown paper from where, you know, half your family lives there. But, you know, the worst cuts of all, out of all of this news, came from the New Orleans Times Picayune, where 200 employees will be fired and the paper is reduced to just 3 days a week, with most of its coverage switching to the web only. So kind of like what happened to the Seattle Times Intelligencer or PI, whatever that newspaper is up there. The entire New Orleans metropolitan area contains more than 1 million people and is the largest city in the U.S. without a daily newspaper so far. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a very big deal. New Orleans is a city famous for corruption. So if there's ever a place that needed a strong local media to keep an eye on the mayor and the cops and the education system and all that, every city needs that. And when newspapers are gone, that's a really serious blow to local coverage of local events. It it's a bad thing. So to see a major city lose their newspaper like this is really hard. And Birmingham, the paper is so thin, you know, you could, you know, blow your nose with it. It's about 2 pages thick. So it's not a surprise that they keep firing more people. I'm surprised it's still around. So we're going to see this more and more across the country. I mean, it's already happening. It's going to happen to bigger cities. New Orleans is a very big city not to have a regular daily paper, but it won't be the last.
Well, you know, last week I was in Spain, as we mentioned earlier, and I was in Arcos, which is one of the White Hill towns, the Pueblo Blancas, these towns that are in the south of Spain. They're Moorish. They're way up on hills usually. And I'm sitting in some bodega, some tiny little restaurant, eating lunch, which apparently is only Manchego cheese and jamón. It seems to be the only thing served there for lunch. Of course, I'm kidding. But and most of these towns are filled with senior citizens, and they're people over 50 or, you know, 60 years old. And I'm watching, and they're all reading newspapers. And I thought, well, they must be reading El País or one of the big national newspapers. No, they're reading a newspaper published in Arcos, a town of maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people, maybe 20,000 if I really want to go beyond. Maybe 20,000 people live in this town, and they have their own pretty decent newspaper.
Well, that's interesting. I wish I could say that was a harbinger of the future, but it seems more like it's probably a vestige of the past, unless you know of some new economic model that they're using to make that happen.
Comedian Arsenio Hall had meteoric success with his late night talk show back in 1989, but then he kind of burned out, really, just after 5 years, and he ended the run of his late night talk show in 1994. Now he's coming back with another syndicated show. This time, however, late night is awfully crowded, and a syndicated show is not exactly cutting edge, when a cable channel seems the more appropriate home for a venture like what Arsenio Hall is trying to launch. Hall will be going up against The Daily Show and Conan at 11 p.m., and of course, you've got Letterman and Leno at 11:30 p.m. Nonetheless, Hall's show is in 17 of the top 20 markets and already reaches 50% of the country. It debuts in the fall of 2012. Big deal or big whoop?
I'm sorry. I think it's the fall of 2013, actually. I don't know if it's this year. I think it might be next fall. I think I made a mistake on those notes, so I apologize for that. I'm not quite sure. I think it's a big whoop.
Okay.
But Arsenio's a big name. You know, he had success. He'll certainly get attention again. But, you know, Russell Brand just launched a show that reached 1 million people on its opening week. It's definitely a much more crowded marketplace. How well he's going to do, I don't know. Syndicated just seems weird to me. You know, it just doesn't seem the right way to do it. But, you know, I guess there's more room there, and he didn't find the right cable channel that made sense for him. So I wouldn't count him out, but we'll see how he does.
And he did syndicated in the past, and, it's still...
No, I know. Today, it just seems for a talk show, it seems not quite the way to go. What I love was a quote from this one executive. He says that, you know, Arsenio had a big following, on his late night show. And that same audience, which was 18 to 34 years old, is now right in the middle of the late night audience, 35 to 54. Those are the demos we're going for now. In other words, Arsenio's fans are older.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much. He was very significant for bringing a new audience to late night television, or at least reaching out to them and making them feel a part of it. He reached out to the Black and Latino crowds. He paved the way for George Lopez and others. He was significant, absolutely, in that way. So maybe those audience feel underserved, and maybe they'll be happy to embrace him again. We'll have to see.
Well, now let's talk about Walt Disney for a second. And I don't mean the man, I mean the company. They opened Cars Land at their California Adventure theme park in Anaheim on June 15th. And of course, Cars Land, guess what it's based on? It's based on the Pixar movies, Cars and Cars 2. We've talked on this show about how it's one of the biggest toy franchises of the 2000s. The themed attractions are, of course, expected to pull in tween and young teen kids and increase attendance and revenue at the park. It's part of a $1.1 billion upgrade that they're doing at California Adventureland, or the equivalent of 6 blockbuster movies before advertising and other costs, because, you know, that's just the budget, $1.1 billion. You know, analysts believe the attractions will prove popular and profitable, making the theme park head Tom Staggs a front runner to replace a guy named Bob Iger, who is now the CEO of Disney. And he's going to step down in 2015. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Right, as far as the transitioning to who will replace Bob Iger, because he's always said, I'm stepping down in 2015. Personally, I don't believe it, but we'll see if it happens. And now Tom Staggs, if he does have a successful launch here, the theme parks are a huge part of Disney. They're profitable. They've remained profitable during the recession. People said, we're broke, but we're going to do this one thing. We're going to go to Disney World. And that's working. And you know, $1.1 billion sounds like a lot, but it's not when you think about it in terms of movies. You know, if you think about how long these rides last for, 10, 15 years, You know, $200 million on a ride does not really seem like that much. So, you know, it's a gamble. This one looks like it's paying off. And they're trying to make this, you know, part of staying longer at Disneyland. You know, you go to Disneyland, they want you to have to be there for 3 days and 4 days and go to California Adventure. They want you to feel like you can't go and get it all done in one day or two.
Or just go to like, you know, Disneyland and not California Adventureland.
Right. They want your kids to go, well, I have to go to the Cars ride, you know.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
So that's and that has not been the case before. California Adventure needs a lot of work, but they're doing it. And of course, down in Florida, they're doing the Avatar themes. So
right.
That's going to be a big step down the road. The Avatar theme parks, that's going to be part of the Disney World. So, you know, it's a good step forward for them. And you cannot overemphasize how big the theme parks are to the bottom line at Disney World.
Well, Michael
World, at the Disney company.
Well, Michael Eisner, who, of course, ran Disney for so many years, more than a decade, he always said, my number one job is filling hotel rooms. So, you know, you're right that those theme parks are important. But you know what Louis C.K.'s job is? He's a comedian.
Filling seats in a theater.
That's right. And he has made waves earlier this year when he sold his last concert film online as a download directly to fans. And he sold it for $5. Now he's getting all like Pearl Jam and String Cheese Incident on us and selling tickets for live shows directly to fans, skipping all the third-party people who pump up the cost with added fees. People like, I don't know, off the top of my head, who would I Ticketmaster. Yeah. He wants to charge $45 for every ticket and says even if he makes less money doing so, he's still making more money than his grandfather did as a math teacher. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. He's not going to change the way business is done. In fact, if you look at the venues he's playing at, in New York, he's playing at City Center. I don't know the last time a comedian, if a comedian has ever played City Center, but it's been a long time. So he has to play offbeat, weird venues because the main venues already have exclusive ticketing arrangements with Ticketmaster and the other services that are out there. That's where they make money. They don't want to give that up. So he's making it happen. He's popular enough to do it. He can play in funky different places. It's not like he's playing, you know, in a warehouse somewhere.
No.
He's playing actual theaters. You can just sit down and watch. It'll be great. But, you know, it's hard to do. It's a lot of work. And it's not going to, you know, trailblaze anything for anybody else. But more power to him. He's taking control of his career. And, you know, he feels like even if it's more work and he makes the same or a little bit less money, he's happier about it if he can keep his fan base happy. And that's smart.
Yeah. And really the way to, I mean, String Cheese Incident proved how you could sell tickets to your fans directly at a Ticketmaster venue. Of course, they had to go to court for it and it took years and it pretty much destroyed the band and, or ultimately nearly destroyed the band, but it's you have to start a fan club. It's kind of a hard to do. So you're right. That's why he's going to all of these different kind of out of the way venues. Well, you know, if you've listened to Showbiz Sandbox, you know we've been saying for a while now that with ebooks, eventually rights to novels will be sold by languages instead of by territory. So the English language instead of the UK and the US separately. In a way, that's beginning to happen from the opposite end. The major publisher HarperCollins has created HarperCollins 360, a program to handle all the works that it owns in the English language, both current and its back catalog. They've started with the U.S. market and are going to expand it to the U.K., Australia, and so on, other English language-speaking territories, until all the titles that they control will be available everywhere. They can sell them in English. When you put out an ebook, do you really care if someone is in Sydney or San Francisco or Dubuque? Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. It's interesting. If you're in charge of hardcovers, eventually you'll be in charge of hardcover releases in English all over the world. If you're in charge of trade paperback, which is those larger size paperbacks that cost like $16, if you're doing that, you'll eventually be in charge of the paperback trade paperback releases everywhere. So you'll know when it's coming out in North America, when it comes out in Australia, when it comes out in England, when it comes out in Spain, or wherever you might put it out, India. So you'll be the guy in charge of that all over the world. Same thing with mass market paperback. Same things with ebooks. So if you're in charge of a format, you're going to be in charge of it everywhere. It's going to be a global enterprise. It just makes sense. You know, it's why would you split it up by country? It doesn't, you know, it's not logical anymore.
Yeah, we've said that for, you know, I can't even remember the first time we said that, but it seems like it's been going on for years that we've been saying that.
The other thing that's rolling the publishing industry is this Department of Justice lawsuit against Apple and several publishers and the deal that they've made with three of them who said that they don't want to go to court fighting this. They just want to settle now. And they've had a period where everybody can comment. I tell you, virtually every single publisher and bookstore and group related to publishing has been commenting on this and excoriating the Department of Justice and saying how bizarre and absurd it is that they are attacking publishers and who are trying to make publishing more competitive and giving a free pass to Amazon, who they think has been a behemoth and is destroying competitiveness. Everybody has commented on these lawsuits. Everyone has commented on the deal and said they're terrible and that the Justice Department should not be telling three of the big six that they can't sell their books a certain way. Every bookstore has said, you're hurting us, you're killing us, you're going to let Amazon destroy the market and control it all themselves, and it's bad for us, and it's bad for the publishing world, and it's bad for consumers. Every single person has weighed in on this.
You know, not to defend the Justice Department here, but, you know, it's kind of like with those incidents where it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. In other words, the agency
They haven't made a good case that there was a crime. Always, obviously, of course, if the people got together and said, hey, let's fix prices, they have to act and have to prosecute. But three of them are fighting. The other three said basically, well, we're not guilty, but we don't want to spend 10 years fighting this in court, spending $30, $40, $80 million. We'd rather just make a deal and walk away.
I don't know whether I said crime or cover-up, but the bottom line is it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. In this case, it's not the agency model. It's the fact that you guys all talked about going to the agency model.
But they didn't. They said they didn't.
Okay,
all the big six guys have come together and said, the idea that we all, you know, got together and price fixed or and decided how to do this is absurd. They said, we got together and we just discussed things in general. There's no smoking gun, and they've laughed off the accusation. The one guy said, I made this alone in my own company. You know, I'm head of this company, and I couldn't decide what to do, and I got feedback from everybody. Half my staff said, yes, agency model. Half said, no, stick to the way we've been doing it. And I finally made the lonely decision myself. My boss has signed off on it. The idea that I got together with the others and we all agreed what to do is absurd, he said. You know, and this is one of the people who's fighting the lawsuit, I believe. So, no, there's no smoking gun.
Well, you know, when I attend some of these industry meetings that set standards, you know, for, say, digital cinema or television, broadcast television, there's always lawyers in the room because it's each meeting starts out with an antitrust disclaimer, meaning please do not talk prices, please do not do anything that is anti-competitive to any of the people in the marketplace because of that very thing. So you're having a casual dinner, and there's, you know, four or five representatives from publishers there. Well, you know, sometimes that can get you into trouble.
They get together every week. They're at cocktail parties. This is a tiny world. They're at cocktail parties every week. They're at dinners and events constantly. These people see each other all the time. This is not an unusual event. It's unusual for the six major studio heads to get together. It's not unusual for publishing. They have an event, everybody shows up.
Yeah. In fact, when I'm negotiating with studios, I can't even say when I'm on certain deals, what other studios have what kind of deal has been struck with other studios for that particular piece of business.
Oh, of course not. So why does this matter to our listeners? It matters because the pricing of ebooks and how they're sold and who's competitive and who's not is a very big deal. If Amazon can dominate the market the way it did when ebooks began and control 90% of the market, they're already offering publishing and self-publishing and the ebook business. If they can drive bookstores out of business, you won't have anywhere to buy books anymore, just like you don't have anywhere to buy music. Most people don't have a good record store in their town anymore. I don't, and I'm in New York City. So, you know, that's a problem. They don't care what you buy. You can buy ebooks, you can buy movies, you can buy razor blades. Amazon just wants you to come to Amazon to buy it. So they have no vested interest in making books flourish. They just want to make money. Bookstores are an important part of a community, and they're going out of business. And one reason is the pricing of Amazon, where they're selling all their ebooks at a loss. For a while there, they sold every ebook and lost $4 to $5 on every single sale. Why? Because they wanted to sell Kindles, and they wanted to dominate the market and drive the others out of business. Yeah, well, that's not a model that's actually good for business. That's bad.
Actually, I lost a Kindle on this trip. And I tried to figure out, okay, is there a way to track it like there is with the iPad? Is there a way to turn it off and make it so that it won't work for anybody? Ultimately, I found the Kindle. However, I found out that basically Amazon, you know, when you lose it, you can deregister it from yourself. Yeah. But if anybody picks it up, they can register it. And so when people basically find Kindles and call and try and find the owner, they say, look, we can't find the owner for you, but hey, it's your Kindle now.
So you've got the serial number. They'll let you use that serial number to register it, even though they know it's not yours?
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty stupid. We had the same thing with cell phones. Rest of the world, if you lose your cell phone, you can decommission it and turn it into a brick.
Right.
And so there's no reason to steal a cell phone. And in fact, cell phone theft in America is a big problem. If you're on a subway in a city, it's dangerous. You know, it's $600 now to get a cell phone. So you can decommission it everywhere else in the world, but not in America. Now they're finally starting to do that. There's no reason whatsoever for Amazon not to change that policy.
Well,
that's
you know,
stupid.
what the pundits are saying is, hey, the reason they're doing that is because, you know, hey, so somebody lost a Kindle, somebody gained a Kindle, and now the person who lost the Kindle will probably buy another one. And now there's an extra Kindle owner out there with the found Kindle who's going
to
buy books.
Encouraging theft is not a good way to do business.
I agree. But, you know, let me ask you something. My cable provider, and I know this seems like a kind of a non sequitur or a tangent, but my cable provider is Time Warner. And Michael, isn't your cable provider Time Warner?
Yes, it is.
Well, it may not be for long. Because Time Warner has just patented a system for disabling the fast-forward feature on DVRs that would stop users from skipping the commercials on shows that they have taped or put on their DVR, since it's not technically a tape. Well, for fans of commercials who want to zip through Modern Family and watch just the ads, this is great. But for the rest of us, it's not so much. Big deal or big what, Michael?
I'm going to say it's a big deal. It's possible they found the technology, and so they patented it just so they can make money off it or prevent someone else from using it without their approval. But if they actually put this into place, I'd be gone in a heartbeat.
I think there's no way whatsoever
I would ever stick with a system where you could not fast forward through commercials or jump them minute by minute. You know, that's absolutely crazy. I can't imagine them going back to that. I can't imagine anyone accepting it. I certainly wouldn't. I would go back to another company, be a satellite company, or I'd go back to a recordable DVD drive or recordable blank disc where you record the show and manually fast forward through on a physical format. I mean, there's no way I would ever go back to watching commercials. The second they did it, I don't often make threats. The second they made it impossible for me to fast forward through commercials, I would drop them.
Hold on. I'm just dialing up the head of Time Warner Cable here so you can make that threat.
that would be just – and everyone I've mentioned it to says the same thing. They're like, oh, my God. They're frightened. They literally freak out when I say that to them. They're like, when is it happening? I go, no, they've just patented it. They may never want to implement it, but it's scary that they have.
Well, now sticking with cable, proving that Mad Men will always be a critic's darling a la The Wire, as opposed to an honest-to-goodness commercial hit, the acclaimed AMC series ended season 5 with a whopping 2.7 million viewers, the most ever for a Mad Men finale. That's just slightly higher than the regular season average of 2.6 million, which means that Curiosity did not bring in any stragglers. The show was up 15% over season 4, but will have to settle for Emmys and heaps of praise since it has long been outpaced by, say, The Walking Dead. And, you know, I have to say, speaking of DVRs, I have the last 3 episodes on my DVR, so don't tell me how it ends. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, my God. You don't know that she... is this a big deal or a big whoop? It is a big deal. It's a big whoop. The ratings are a big whoop by definition. I mean, if this keeps up, it keeps growing. So in about 15 years, they'll have themselves a hit.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, and frankly, they have a lot of mind share. Let's put it that way. They take up a lot of mind power. I mean, now The Gap and Banana Republic, they all have Mad Men lines. It took them a while to actually do that, but probably too long. But now everybody's copying Mad Men.
I think when the show hits DVD, which will be slightly before the next season begins, and more, you know, it's a good cast. They're trying to make an intelligent show, but I've been off the show since season 2. I mean, the first season I liked. I've not really liked the show since then. I find it very frustrating. This season I found as frustrating, if not more, than ever. And the problems are endless as far as I'm concerned. I'm finally, you know, I don't like being contrary particularly. I don't like, it sounds silly for me to say, but it's true. I never was a big fan of The Sopranos, and I don't want to go, show sucks. It did suck. It's a good cast. They had some great episodes. They had some good seasons. I just was not a huge fan of it. Mad Men, I can't understand that people have not turned on this show.
It's a good show.
It's so badly done in so many ways. It drives me crazy, but it's just absurd. But I'm going to finally just go in depth on it when the DVD comes out and detail all the things I think are wrong with the show. I think it's incompetent. I think the writing and production of it is terrible. The actors are good. They've been asked to do moronic things. And this season, they almost all betrayed themselves yet again, doing things their characters would never do. And yet, we're just supposed to go along with it. I think I'm so over the show. But anyway. Breaking Bad is the great show. Breaking Bad has not missed a beat. It's terrific. Oh, my God. What a good show.
Well, you know, you mentioned that Mad Men will be released on DVD, and in a somewhat unrelated story, HBO mentioned that the fantasy series Game of Thrones set a one-week sales record by moving 350,000 DVDs and Blu-rays of season 1. That's more in 1 week, by the way, than The Sopranos that you just mentioned, Sex and the City, or any show in HBO history. It's it's true that Game of Thrones, though, may be the most pirated show on TV this season, but it's also proving a huge seller on DVD. So, you know, piracy doesn't seem to be affecting it there. And it's proving that people who really do want to pay for what they want to watch, if they perceive there's some value there and you make it available in a legitimate way. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. Season two grew from season one. It's turned into a real hit for HBO, unlike, say, Mad Men. It's a commercial and critical success. It's growing. It's not as big as True Blood yet, but I think it'll get there. Did pirate episodes make people want to buy the box set? I don't think so. You know, people always argue that. I think it's more likely that the people who pirated always pirated, and the people who bought the box set were just waiting for that. They don't own HBO, and when the DVD set comes out, they want to buy it and watch it or rent it. Would they have sold more copies if they released their box set when the season ended? Absolutely. I don't know why they want to make it so exclusive that you have to get HBO. So they waited till the middle of season two before they released season one on DVD. I think that's just crazy. They should put out season two as soon as it's over. I know they want to make HBO valuable, but people who own HBO see great value in it. They have, you know, they have the show. They can watch every past season, every show of HBO ever made. You know, they don't need to have that window of 8 months where they are the only ones who can watch the show legally. I think it should come out on DVD as soon as possible. But I must say, I am really thinking of signing up for HBO again. They have True Blood, Game of Thrones. Newsroom just started with Aaron Sorkin. That got renewed for a second season. Girls, Veep. Bill Maher. They've got a lot of shows on right now that I want to watch. So
hire you as a salesperson, because now I want to subscribe.
Yeah, I'm gonna bite the bullet and go back to getting HBO again.
And then, of course, you'll have HBO Go on your iPad.
Right. And I still wish they'd put out the DVD sooner.
Right. Well, you know, we should talk very quickly about some lawsuits. Netflix failed to have a lawsuit over its streaming content thrown out of court. A judge ruled that the American Disabilities Act, the ADA, which applies to mostly the physical world, well, it applies online as well. And so he or she allowed a lawsuit by the National Association for the Deaf to go forward against Netflix. Now, the National Association for the Deaf want to require Netflix, and by the way, all other streaming content providers, to allow for closed caption on streaming video services. Closed caption is available on DVDs, as we all know. So to comply with the law, Netflix would either have to turn off any streaming video that didn't provide closed captioning, or better yet, work with studios to make certain that the closed captioning available on DVD was also available for streaming video. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I think it's great. I think they should do it. If the content is available, they should work with the studios to make it available for streaming video. They should have always been doing that. This is a great use of the law. It seems, you know, it's a small minority of the country, but it's a great thing to have done. And you know what? Old people, or people who are slightly hard of hearing, or people who just can't quite follow what's being said, like it's a British show or The Wire. I have often used the closed captioning on The Wire, HBO's great series. Having closed captioning available for streaming when that's the way you're going, it's essential. They've got to get it done anyway. It's smart for business in a lot of ways. And I'm glad that the ADA ruling is helping that happen.
Well, it's not an ADA ruling.
I'm saying, well, the ADA law is helping this lawsuit move forward. And I think it's a great example of unintended consequences that are a positive for a lot of people, not just the deaf community. Obviously, nobody who's deaf listens to our show. We don't have a text version of the show.
Yet, but we have
friends of the deaf and old people and people who watch British series and like to have closed captioning. You know, you're going to make everything available streaming. You should be doing this even without the prompting of the lawsuit, and you'll be happy that you did.
Right, and I assume that the technology is there for them to stream closed captions.
Right, I mean, they've got to work it out, and they should have been doing it, and this will be the nudge to get them to do it, and they should have just been something that they did without even thinking, and now they're aware of it, now the lawsuit's going forward. Hopefully, they will just all start doing this, do whatever work needs to be done, it's some new coding, but then once they've done it once, it'll be there forever, and they won't have to think about it again.
Well, let's stick with lawsuits for a second. Hayden Christensen, do you remember him? He's the Mark Hamill of the first three Star Wars films.
That's right.
Hollywood is they're very nervous over a lawsuit which is, you know, winding its way through the courts that actor Hayden Christensen has filed along with his brother. And they pitched a show to the USA Network about a doctor who was tossed out of the medical community because he kept treating patients that couldn't pay.
So that's not allowed.
That's not allowed. And then, you know, the doctor moved to Malibu in this story to cater to the rich. They had what's called a full show Bible, which is, you know, basically all the episodes lined up. They had that in their, you know, elaborate pitch, and USA later launched the very similar Royal Pains, and Christensen is now suing over that. They didn't sue for copyright infringement, but the newish concept of breach of implied contract over the idea theft. So that approach worked in a lawsuit over the reality series Ghost Hunters that went all the way to the Supreme Court. Now Hollywood is kind of terrified it will be easier to make claims over TV shows and movies that are similar to one another. And of course, as you know, in Hollywood, that's a huge problem. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal because getting a successful lawsuit over idea theft is hard, as it should be. You got to be able to prove it, but it's very hard. This could make it easier or perhaps too easy as far as Hollywood is concerned. There are a lot of shows and movies with very similar ideas. It happens all the time. But then sometimes there's something like this where you feel like, boy, that really sounds like it's an unfortunate example of somebody coming to you with an idea and then you go do it anyway and then tell them, oh, no, we had that idea on our own. In fact, the executive who testified in the case that Hayden Christensen pitched this to had said he'd never heard of a doctor doing a house call before. That's one of the things to show. He goes to the mansions of the rich and famous. Of course, they don't come to him. He comes to them on Royal Pains. And the guy said, oh, I'd never heard of that before. So, you know, there are elements of the show that, you know, seem to have been news to them. You know, be interesting to see how it turns out. You don't want to make idea theft too easy to prove because, there's so many similar ideas out there. And everybody's pitching everybody with everything. But, you know, it's probably been too hard in the past. So we'll have to see how this plays out.
Well, that kind of concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week, moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. We're running a little long this week, but we should talk about how Rupert Murdoch has become King Solomon, as I kind of tried to make light of at the opening of the show. Turns out that News Corp is confirming their plans to split the company in two. There's going to be a media and entertainment side, and a publishing side. So there's 20th Century Fox and the Fox News Channel. That'll all be on one side. And then you have the Wall Street Journal and the Times of London and HarperCollins. They're all going to be on the publishing side.
So when was the last time you actually read the Bible?
The Bible? I don't know where that's... Oh, you know what?
He's not King Solomon.
I knew it. You know, I have to say, when I put that in, I was, you know, it was on the run-up to the show. I said, I don't know if it was King Solomon or somebody else. I don't know. I'll stick with King Solomon.
No, you've got King Solomon. You're right. That's who you're thinking of. But King Solomon did not cut anything into two. He threatened to cut them into two to find out who the real mother was. Two women said the baby was theirs. And he said, well, I'll cut it in half and you can each have half. And one woman immediately said, no, let her have the baby. And so then he realized that was the true mother because she cared for the child and would rather have the child live with someone else than die. So he threatened to split something in two in order to ascertain the truth, but then he didn't actually do it. Rupert Murdoch isn't threatening to do it to try and get some larger claim. He's actually cutting it in two. So it's your illusion was okay, but, you know, just the details, you know, the God is in the details. And in this case, the God is Rupert Murdoch. And he's saying, I want to split these into two companies. Why? Well, because Nucor is a massive multi, you know, national conglomerate. It's a little hard and unwieldy. Is he doing it because of the lawsuits and the crimes that were committed in the publishing side? He says no. They've been working on this for several years. More importantly, he says, I want to be the head of
both
the publishing side. No. He's going to be the chairman of both.
That's right.
But he says that the publishing side, the newspapers, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Times of London, he says they're a lot more valuable than you realize.
Right. I mean, they're going to be valued at around $5 billion, which is, you know, way below what the News Corp is valued at. And so, you know, a lot of people see the publishing side as kind of a shrinking business, a business that's going away. It's kind of an antiquated business model with all of its newspapers. And they don't really put much stock in it. They don't think it's worth very much. But he's saying, as you said, Michael, you know, absolutely not. You know, our publishing business are greatly undervalued by the skeptics, he said.
Right. Newspapers are collapsing, but the ones that remain, like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times, they're going to be bigger than ever because their value will be stronger than ever. And they're going to be national newspapers, as they already are, international newspapers, international sources of information. And he thinks down the road, they will become even more valuable, along with HarperCollins, which he thinks they can transition to the ebook era. So he's saying, when we split these in two, what happens when you break up a company? Suddenly you find out one division is a lot more trouble than you realize, and another one is a lot more profitable or does better. So he's betting that, you know, one and one is going to equal three, that you take this company, you split it in two, they're not going to be worth the same, that they're going to increase in value because they'll be leaner, smarter. And in this case, people will appreciate better the actual profitability that's going to be happening in the print area. So I think it's an interesting decision. I think it matters if you're a shareholder. I'm not sure how it matters if you're just a regular user. It'll be invisible to you for a while. The funny thing I think is that Fox News, of course, it's not publishing, so it's on the entertainment side. So it's there with 20th Century Fox and the movies and all that stuff.
Proving once again that it is not news, but go ahead.
Exactly. It's just a question of the media that it's in. But it's funny that it's been separated from the Wall Street Journal and the Times of London and all the serious news areas, and it's been thrown over into the entertainment side. That's because it's television. Nonetheless, it seems fitting.
Well, you know, a couple things. One, you know, a lot of pundits pointed out that the publishing side had been buttressed by the media and entertainment side, that, you know, 20th Century Fox, Fox News, they were making a mint, while the publishing side wasn't making that much and needed the media and entertainment side to survive. Well, now they won't have that. Also, Rupert Murdoch had historically been against splitting the company in two. And you mentioned that he said and publicly stated that it's not because of this phone hacking scandal in the UK that this is happening. And he didn't really say anything about, you know, Lachlan Murdoch, his son, and I guess he did, because he said if one of his children wants to be the heir to the empire there, then they're going to have to earn it. And there, some thought was given that maybe Lachlan Murdoch, who had to step down because of this phone hacking scandal, would come back and take over the publishing side. Like, this was a way for Lachlan Murdoch to come back into the fold without taking over the same company again.
And yet that's not the case. The CEO of the other side is going to be, what's his name?
Chase Carey.
Chase Carey will be the CEO. Is that what he is, of the publishing side?
No, entertainment. He's going to be the CEO of the entertainment and media business as he is today.
Okay, and Rupert Murdoch will be above him?
Yes, chairman.
And he's going to be chairman of both divisions. I thought he was only going to be chairman of one of them.
No.
But he's going to be chairman of both?
Yes.
All right. So he owns the New York Post. The New York Post has always lost money for many, many, many years. That's going to continue, I assume, though they have a good online presence. But we'll have to see if he can make that publishing division be more valuable. Be interested to see how they react to being a little looser, a little goosier, a little more free to move.
Well, due to time, we should probably move along into our listener email. We got a lot of listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. I'd like to, I highlighted one here from Thierry Keegan, who is from the Netherlands, who sent us a link to a video which explains exactly when Michael will get the original versions of the first Star Wars trilogy on Blu-ray. It's called The Star Wars That I Used to Know. It's on YouTube. And it's really a parody of the hit song Somebody That I Used to Know by Gautier. And it's it's actually quite funny. And I'm going to see if I can skip ahead here.
That is Gautier in it?
No. It's a parody.
Yeah, it's a parody. Yeah, I'm like, what are you talking about? Yeah, no, it's a very funny. It's just new lyrics about Star Wars and the world and how George Lucas ruined their lives. And I was saying, you're never going to get to see it on Blu-ray. Never.
Yeah.
And it's very funny.
Here, I'll play that part.
Now and then I think of all the times I screwed fans over.
This is Lucas singing.
I had them believing that the first three films were really done. But Star Wars will be done my way. I don't care what they have to say. I think that they should let it go, and they'll never get a Blu-ray of the Star Wars that you used to know.
Didn't have to change it all. No more profits, no more practical effects or nothing.
This is the best part.
Do we really need to watch them all again in 3D? Jar Jar was an all-time low. What happened to the Star Wars that I used to know?
It's a funny video. I mean, it looks like it's 5 minutes long, but a lot of that is credits and the guys who did the video talking about future projects. So it's really about 3.5 minutes long. So if you're in the mood, check a link out on our show notes and see what you think.
Yeah, and they actually also were very, very good at copying the original Gautier video, which is like Sledgehammer, all animated and stop motion at times.
Thanks a lot, Thierry.
Yes, thank you. And that concludes our show for this week. Again, you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes. I don't know if the Zune Marketplace is still around, but You can subscribe there if it is, or Stitcher, or in your favorite podcatcher, or in RSS, or we can send you an email every time we post another episode. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find the ways to subscribe to us. Also, ways to follow us. We're on Facebook under Showbiz Sandbox. We have a Facebook page. You can like us there, or you can follow us on Twitter, where our username is Showbiz Sandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael has a website. It is?
MichaelGiltz.com.
And that's where all of your writing can be found. You're traveling this week in Birmingham. When do you return?
I'll be back in New York for next week's show. And I will have finally watched The Amazing Spider-Man.
Perfect. Some of my writing can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. And until next week, play nice.
Where's the Showbiz Sandbox that I used to know?
And that's why we're journalists, not...
Hey!